Sonali Kohatkar.
Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, The Struggle with Alyssa.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the East Portland Arts and Literary Festival, Friday, October 4th through Sunday, October 6th at FUBON and the Orchids of 82nd Community Space in Portland. The third annual East Portland Arts and Literary Festival features live performances, interactive creative activities, a book and craft fair, and a full family-friendly lineup of artists and cultural workers of color. Again, that's the East Portland Arts and Literary Festival, Friday, October 4th through Sunday, October 6th at FUBON, 2850 Southeast 82nd Avenue, and at Orchids of 82nd Community Space, 8118 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information about specific events, times, and location can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of That's No Lady, That's Darcel, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall in Portland. Walter Cole owned the first Portland coffee bar, then bought an old barren wine tavern. He began a drag act that, in 1974, became Darcel 15. This musical tells the life story of Walter, Darcel, and more. Again, that's Triangle Productions, That's No Lady, That's Darcel, from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall, located at 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, everyone. This is Alyssa and Olivia. This week on The Struggle on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, thank you for tuning in. We want to speak about the story that I know that a lot of you have already heard of. Botham Jean, a man who was killed by Amber Geiger, his neighbor and Dallas police officer who actually got convicted. Finally, there's a conviction for a police officer who kills an unarmed black man. This time it was because she went into his apartment. She said that she thought it was her own and shot him while he was watching television on his couch. And we're going to play a clip to give you some background so that you all can hear for yourself. This is a replay from Democracy Now a few days ago. Democracy Now every day on KBOO, this is what was played. So let's get everyone up to speed before we jump in.
A white police officer who shot and killed a 26-year-old black man in his own home in Dallas in 2018 has been convicted of murder. The verdict came down Tuesday, more than a year after off-duty police officer Amber Geiger killed Botham Jean. Geiger claimed during trial that she accidentally entered Jean's apartment and shot him, thinking he was an intruder. Jean's apartment was located one floor below Geiger's in the Dallas apartment building. This is Judge Tammy Kemp delivering the verdict.
The jury having reached a verdict, Ms. Geiger and your team, would you please stand? We, the jury, unanimously find the defendant, Amber Geiger, guilty of murder as charged in the indictment.
Fam, family and community members in the courthouse erupted in celebration at the news. In the hallways, spectators chanted Black Lives Matter. Geiger is the first Dallas police officer to be convicted of murder since the 1970s. This according to the Dallas Morning News. This is Lee Merritt, one of the lawyers for Botham Jean's family.
We still have the sentencing phase to go, but this is a huge victory, not only for the family of Botham Jean, but as his mother, Allison, told me a moment ago, this is a victory for black people in America. It's a signal that the tide is going to change here. Police officers are going to begin to be held accountable for their actions, and we believe that that will begin to change policing culture all over the world.
Amber Geiger faces up to 99 years in prison. This is the family's lawyer, Benjamin Crump, speaking Tuesday.
This verdict is for Trayvon Martin. It's for Michael Brown. It's for Sandra Bland. It's for Tamir Rice. It's for Eric Gardner. It's for Antoine Rose. It's for Jamel Roberson, for E.J. Bradford, for Stephon Clark, for Jeffrey Dennis, Genevieve Doss, for Pamela Turner, for so many unarmed black and brown human beings all across America. This verdict today is for them.
After the jury returned its verdict, prosecutors introduced racist and offensive text messages and social media posts written by Geiger, in which she joked about Martin Luther King Jr.'s death and called herself a racist. Well, for more, we go to Dallas, Texas, to speak with Benjamin Crump, an attorney for the family of Botham Jean. He is the author of the upcoming memoir, Open Season, Legalized Genocide of Colored People. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ben Crump. First of all, just overall respond to the verdict. As we speak, the sentence has not been decided.
Correct. But it was a historic verdict yesterday, just in the fact my co-counsels, Darrell Washington and Lee Merritt, we believe that this is the first time that a white policewoman has ever been convicted of murder of a black man in America. So we don't underscore this decision by this jury in any way. It was a huge verdict, not just for Botham Jean's family, but for so many others who never got justice for the unjustified killings of their loved ones. And the one thing I would say, Amy, is Botham Jean was a near perfect person of color. And I believe that the jury took that into account as they were deliberating. But it shouldn't take you being a near perfect person of color for an unarmed person of color to get justice in America. And so we are still trying to say that everybody, regardless of your social status or the index of your income, should get equal justice under the law. That's what the Constitution says.
I want to turn to Botham Jean's mother, Allison, testifying Tuesday after the verdict was delivered.
My life has not been the same. It's just been like a roller coaster. I cannot sleep. I cannot eat. It's just been the most terrible time for me. I'm not able to work, but I just try to busy myself just to see if it will get out of my head. But it's been very, very, very difficult.
That's Botham Jean's mother, Allison. Again, the decision on the sentence will be made, we believe, today. Ben Crump,
yes.
If you could give us the narrative of exactly what happened for those people who haven't followed this just unbelievable case. You have Amber Geiger. She has worked her day of on her job. And then describe what happens and when it was.
Certainly. Amber Geiger, a Dallas police officer, who lives in the same apartment complex as Botham Jones, this 26-year-old highly educated African-American man who was a certified public accountant working for Price Waterhouse Cooper. She lives on the third floor. Right above her, Botham Jones lives on the fourth floor. She comes and she gets off on the wrong floor and she puts her key into Botham's apartment. At this apartment complex, they've had some issues apparently with the doors. Many witnesses testified. But when she puts her key in the door opens. At that point, she says, understand that she heard somebody moving around in the apartment. Now, she's a well-trained police officer, allegedly. Her training tells her if she thinks it's a burglar or somebody doing something nefarious in her apartment, at that point, the best thing for her to do is to set up a perimeter, call for backup. The police department is less than 2 miles away. They would be there within 90 seconds. The cavalry, the K-9 unit, everybody give her cover. And they can give out verbal commands, and they can de-escalate the situation if it really is a nefarious situation. But she doesn't do any of that. She testifies that when she heard that, she said she assumed it was a burglar or a threat, and she was going in to take the threat out. And that's exactly what she did. The unfortunate tragedy is that it was Botham Jones' apartment. He was in there eating a bowl of ice cream, watching the football game, working, doing everything he had the legal right to do. And unfortunately, because she prejudged him, prejudged the situation, she shot first and asked questions later, this light in this war has been taken away from us. And it's something his family will never get over. So that's why you heard his mother breaking down on the witness stand, because he was truly a light for this war that was so desperately needed. And the last thing I will say is that Amber Geiger, you know, she tried to say that it was the worst day of her life and that she doesn't think anybody can understand that this is the worst day of her life. The prosecutors, when they cross-examined her, they pointed out the fact, but you didn't treat it like you had made this terrible mistake. You were texting on the phone with your partner slash lover. You were not trying to render any aid to this unarmed person who you had now realized was innocent and that you were in the wrong apartment. So it was these things here that were so unbelievably outrageous that she did on multiple occasions that I believe led the jury to say that you do not get the benefit of consideration or mistake based on all the decisions that you made to kill this unarmed black man in his own apartment.
I'm looking at a piece in the New York Times today, Ben, and it says, talking about now the sentencing phase of this trial, whether she'll get, she faces between 5 and 99 years in prison. And it says, prosecutors sought, the jury, which will decide the length of punishment, began hearing testimony in the sentencing portion of the trial. Prosecutors sought to draw the jury's attention to past social media posts by Ms. Geiger, including a post, "Kill first, die last," that she'd saved to a page for quotes and inspiration. The prosecution also highlighted a text they said Ms. Geiger sent while working at a parade celebrating the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When asked when the festivities would end, she wrote, "When MLK is dead, oh wait." Ben Crump.
Yeah, it's just shocking. These posts that this police officer was sending to her partner, Martin Rivera, who she was having an affair with. And remember, she was sexting with him 20 minutes before she killed Botham Jones. But there are many posts where she said, "I wear black and I have a gun, so don't F with me. Because I'm already dressed for your funeral." And so I think these posts kind of give us some perspective of her mentality. And I don't know if she is racist. I don't know the woman at all, but these posts certainly suggest that she had an issue with people of color, because there were some other posts in there where she suggested what to do with the crowds of the diverse crowds of people who were celebrating at the Martin Luther King parade, how you should just mace them and do these other things that violate their constitutional rights. So I think the jury will have all of these things to consider when they put a verdict for the sentence of this white policewoman, Amber Geiger, who killed this unarmed black man in his own apartment in Dallas, Texas.
I'm wondering your response to activists calling for the resignation of Dallas Police Union President Mike Mata over the alleged special treatment he gave Amber Geiger. Prosecutors arguing Mata instructed a Dallas police sergeant to turn off the recording system inside the patrol car that would transport Geiger to the station after the shooting. Your response?
No, it's no question they treated her differently than they would have treated any other suspect who had just killed an unarmed person in their own apartment. They were violating policies when they said turn off the video camera, instructing her not to say anything, because these were all people who she associated with on a regular basis. So it was almost as if they were trying to come up with a justification for this unjustifiable killing from day one, from moment one. They were trying to conspire how to make sure she would walk and not be held accountable for this crime. And when you really think about it, when you listen to the 911 tape, she never once said that she felt threatened by Botham Jones, that he was charging her or anything like that. She just said that she messed up. She went to the wrong apartment. She's sorry. She's sorry. And this call was about 19 minutes. It was only after she had talked to and, we believe, been coached by the union president and others, that she came up with this notion to say, well, I felt threatened. I thought he was going to kill me. And remember, the United States Supreme Court has given the instructions to all police officers when they kill unarmed people of color. All you have to do is say, I felt threatened. I felt in fear of my life. And normally that means you get a get out of jail pass free card for killing black and brown people. And I think that's what people are so outraged about in the activists and civil rights community, that this union president can do this, be caught on tape doing it, and have no consequences, just like her and her partner slash lover who was married deleting text messages from their phones, knowing that that was a vital part of the criminal investigation into the death of Botham Jones.
Finally, the message you sent, you think this sends to the African American community, to the United States of America, every population, Ben Crump?
Yeah, Amy, I think this is a precedent-setting case in many ways. We pray that it will decrease the hashtags of unarmed black and brown people being killed by the people who are supposed to protect and serve us. We hope that it sends the message to the police departments that your officers should be following the policies of de-escalation so we can have conflict resolution and not this shoot first, ask questions later mentality when it comes to interactions with black and brown people. And the last thing for society as a whole, we pray that it would be a precedence to reaffirm what the United States Constitution has emblazoned on our society, that it is equal justice under the law.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Ben Crump, civil rights attorney, attorney for the family of Botham Jean. He's the author of the upcoming memoir, Open Season, Legalized Genocide of Colored People. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the protests in Hong Kong. And then we'll talk about protests in Haiti. Stay with us.
Okay. Thank you, y'all. So you were just listening to Ben Crump, who is the lawyer for the family of Botham Jean, the man who was killed by Amber Geiger Dallas police officer when he was in his apartment eating ice cream on his couch watching football.
How dare he?
So,
thank God.
His book, Ben Crump, the lawyer, is called Open Season. It's forthcoming, and it's about the impunity that officers are able to look forward to if they kill people. So one of the last things that he said that I thought was really key is that the advice that is given to police officers that all you have to do is say that you felt threatened.
Mm-hmm.
So Officer Amber Geiger did say that she felt threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought that that was going to be her get out of jail free card.
Mm-hmm. And she's in jail for 10 years. So she thought wrong. But yeah, it's pretty clear. I mean, because the story that she has is that she thought it was her apartment. And the original story is that she thought it was her apartment. She went into the apartment. She heard somebody rustling around and she killed them on site. And so while that's unbelievable, first of all, that you went into an apartment, you used your own key to open somebody else's apartment on the wrong floor, and you walked in and he was rustling around even though he was watching TV on the couch in the living room, and then you thought it was okay to shoot him. That's already unbelievable. And then just the, I don't know, the all of it sounds wrong. All of it's off. And like he says in the tape, she only came up with the story that she felt threatened after the fact, after making it to the police station without being recorded, having her buddies in the force allow her to go without being recorded.
The union president
told her not to say anything. The union president. This is why police officers can't unionize. This is why police officers are not the working class.
It's very important because it goes against the bad apple theory.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is willing to admit that this officer was not so great, but they're ready to say that generally that the police are good with them, just look at this case because here you have a bad apple, right? And that bad apple is being coached by the union apples. President. Mata is the name of the union president of the Dallas police. And he put in a request to have the recording turned off in the car, coached her not to say anything in the car. So that's not a good cop holding a bad cop responsible. That's the person that's in charge of the entire force or for representing them. That's coaching someone who just committed murder
on
how to get away with it.
That's the progressive wing of the force, because I do believe that even in police unions, it's probably going to be the more progressive wing of the police force. But like I was saying before, and something that AJ Mendoza, friend of the show,
AJ Mendoza, the solidarity organizer with Portland Jobs with Justice. Hi, AJ.
He was on one of the first shows that I was on and talking about how police are not a part of the working class, and we should not actually think of police as having the right to organize the way the rest of the working class do, because how is it empowering the working class to allow the force that is explicitly used to disempower them, to kill them, to break up strikes, to break up protests, and is made up of people who can kill working class people with impunity. How is it empowering us to have them organize? And so when you see this union president of the police force allowing this woman to not just murder somebody, but to helping her maneuver around being accountable for what she did, it shows you that police unions are not do nothing for regular people, do nothing for working people, do nothing for marginalized people. They only empower the force that the police are, which is a force that is meant to break down marginalized people and working people.
Yeah. So I don't know the stories of any of the people who were on the jury for Amber Geiger, the officer that killed him. I would like to one day be able to read and hear some of their perspectives, because typically this is something that is very obviously something that they get away with every time. Mm-hmm. But this time it was a little bit different. And my gut instinct is to say that the people that were on the jury mm-hmm. have been affected by the social tide mm-hmm. moving away from deferring to the police mm-hmm. every time.
I mean, I think you would have to. I hope that you would. But we continue. I don't know. I have a hard time believing that just because this is, like they said in the clip, this is the first conviction of a Dallas police officer since the 1970s. And this is something that we see less than 10, less than 5% of the time. Police officers are almost never. And again, not that we don't call into question the mechanism of policing and the prison system. And this is the mechanism that we have to hold police officers accountable in this day and age. And that mechanism is hardly ever used to incarcerate the people who work within it, to convict the people who work within it, and to hold them accountable in the way that we have yeah. right now. And so, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I mean, I hope that this is indicative of a shift in perspectives of policing, especially in a community like Dallas. Mm. And I don't know, because it's so rare.
Well, I think that the analysis that this is a victory for mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. is true. So if it wasn't for all of the activism mm-hmm. around this, trying to force mm-hmm. the hand of the state to hold yeah. officers accountable, to be able to get justice for the people that are being affected by these systems, mm-hmm. that it's because of the tireless fighting that's been going on the ground for a long time that we even see this small mm-hmm. win. And I disagree with people who think that this is the beginning of a tide changing and that there will be mm-hmm. more cases like this. I actually don't know, because this one was really airtight.
It was. I mean, yeah. And we can say that. With other cases, you can see the way that police maneuver around it. But I think it's the fact that this person was in his home being as benign and docile as you can possibly, I mean, sitting on his literal couch in his house alone, mm-hmm. watching football and eating ice cream. Like, and the fact that this is the one case that we have as of recently where somebody is convicted shows you how docile you have to be as a Black person for somebody to believe that you didn't deserve to be murdered.
Yeah.
That is the level of non-threatening that you have to be for somebody to believe that it's possible for a police officer to kill you for no good reason.
Yeah, I don't want people to get the wrong idea that the court system mm-hmm. is going to deliver justice, or that necessarily justice was served in this case. The family, an updated mm-hmm. or an update on what has gone on since the clip that we just played mm-hmm. is that there has been sentencing. Mm-hmm. She was sentenced to 10 years. And also, Botham's brother.
Mm-hmm. And his father, I believe.
Forgave her. Mm-hmm. And his brother hugged her. The judge hugged her.
The father hugged her. The brother hugged her. A whole bunch of people hugged her.
So that's an important update. That
is an important update.
The level of humanity inside of their hearts to be able to do. I know I wouldn't. They're better than me.
Oh, a lot better than me. A lot better than me. A lot better than me.
So if people want to call in, leave a note with the producer, let us know what you think mm-hmm. on this note. We can bring it in. While we're speaking about this, but I wanted to dedicate the show to this week, because we've been fighting, a lot of the listeners to The Struggle, mm-hmm. a lot of people who I've marched in the streets with for Don't Shoot Portland over the years. Like, we've been chanting Black Lives Matter, and we've been part of this movement for a long time. And I just want people to be able to think about this moment and to perhaps rededicate themselves to mm-hmm. reviving holding police officers to account when they kill black people. Mm-hmm. So again, Open Season is the name of Ben Crump's book. Mm-hmm. Ben Crump is the lawyer for the family of Botham John. Mm-hmm. And I think that he's going to be touching on a lot of this, because if you listen to what he was saying in the interview, he was being quite spicy with his hot takes.
He said she was sexting 20 minutes before, which has nothing to do with what
nothing.
She did.
But having an affair.
I mean, I love the spice. I don't care. I do not care about that woman at all.
She doesn't care about you.
She sure don't care about me.
No, kill first, die last.
That's what she said, and she did die last.
But that's her inspirational quote.
No, that was so, I mean, kill first, die last. She did that, but now you're in jail for 10 years, sweetie. So,
oh my god.
Sorry.
That's really sick. And then what was the other sick thing that she said?
Oh,
she
said somebody that, said when it was so this is the woman who killed Botham John in his home. This is the kind of person that we're talking about. A police officer, she said she was at some kind of parade for Martin Luther King, which, like, why are you there? And somebody texted her.
She was on the job.
Oh, crowd that control. Makes sense. I'm an idiot. Anyway, why were you there anyway? Why are police ever there? Somebody texted her and said, when is everything over? When is it ending? And she said, when Martin Luther King dies. Oh, wait. Which, first of all, isn't even funny. Second of all, like, just disgusting. A disgusting
person.
She
said that they should have
done something to the crowd there.
Pepper sprayed the crowd.
Yeah, he said maced.
Yeah,
maced the crowd. How the people there who were it must have been, because they weren't even
protesting.
He said he called it a parade, but then referred to it as protest. The point is, this woman is racist,
sadistic, and racist. Yes,
and wants to see harm done to people who are fighting in the name of civil rights and anti-racism. I feel good about what she is about to experience. This is going off of kind of what the beginning of you just of what the last thing you said was, but we can't be fooled into thinking that this kind of violence is going to end by just continued pressure on the court system. Even if we had millions and millions and millions and billions of people in the street, if all of that pressure was being geared toward the court system, it wouldn't do anything, because the court system is a part of the system that enables police officers and allows police officers to kill people with impunity.
Yeah.
It's this kind of racism is embedded into the foundation of policing.
And even when there is mass upheaval, the police are not going to be held accountable for the violence that they do generally, because they will always assert that they're acting in the interest of the public. Mm-hmm. Even though you look at Honduras, Sudan, Malaysia, Hong Kong this year, and it's the majority of the population is pouring out into the streets demanding one thing or another.
That has to do with basic rights, basic standard of living, and not being marginalized.
The police are not protecting the people. They are openly attacking the people that are on the streets. So I want to bring this up as often as I can, because in the words of Malcolm X, the chickens are coming home to roost. So I don't want people in the U.S. to feel like, oh, that's over there, that can't happen here.
It is happening here.
It's already happening here, and it's definitely going to be as brutal, if not more brutal, when it's here, because of the amount of financial interests that are being protected by the police here. Hello?
And the amount of financial power that the U.S. has. U.S. military, largest in the world. World's 47th largest polluter. Big old guns, big old stuff that they fully have the power to use against us and are using against us. And if you don't see that, just because you're not in the street or you live in a community where you aren't forced to experience it. But it is happening. It absolutely is happening.
So to people that are from down south, you know, there's a nasty tendency for us to think that this is the kind of stuff that happens in the South, but it is as brutal here or New Jersey where I'm from or anywhere else that you want to name when the police are involved. It may be that the cultural attitudes are different from place to place, but the police protocols are the same all over. And they get their memos from the national levels that they organize amongst themselves with. And I don't want people to feel like in the Portland area that something like this couldn't happen here. Something like this absolutely could happen here.
I mean, things like this do, and I think that's something we have to keep touching on, is that the reason that this case is getting the attention that it is, even though it should get attention, and the reason that this woman is getting jail time, even though so many of her peers don't, and many of them probably will continue to not, it is because it was open and shut. He was in his house.
Yeah.
She was not on duty. She walked in. He wasn't threatening her. And she admitted in the 911 call that she made a mistake, and she's an idiot and who had racist stuff on her Facebook. But that is... doesn't make it any worse than any other case. Black people are killed with impunity.
Right.
Unarmed Black people are killed with impunity. Mentally ill, trans, like all different kinds of marginalized people, Black people are killed with impunity every single day in this country, and armed and unarmed. And that does happen in Portland and has happened in Portland for the last decade, two decades, since the beginnings of the state and the city. And it will continue to happen. It is happening here.
It's going to be interesting to see what activists do in the next period in Dallas, because this is definitely a boon to morale. But without struggle, there's no progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
Frederick Douglass, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Because if this is the justice that is brought to, you know, they listed like more than a dozen names. They called off Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin,
and I
Mike
think some
Brown
from the Dallas area.
So they were saying that this is justice for them. This is not justice for them.
Oh,
though,
it's absolutely not,
because their officers are still working.
Well, and I just get really frustrated when our framing of justice, because that's a big word to me, when our framing of justice comes from the court system, like. We need to, this is a win for the Black Lives Matter movement. It's not a win for those families of the people that they mentioned. And like, we can have a victory and then be very critical and say, we need to go farther than this. Because even if police officers do begin to be convicted at a slightly higher rate, higher than what it is now, which is like, what, 1%? Like, it's less than 5% of police officers are convicted, even if that does begin to happen.
Is it more than 1%?
Not,
no.
No, it's I think it's 1.
I think you were closer.
Yeah, I think it is 1%. Even if they do begin to be convicted at a higher rate, I don't believe that that's actually going to curb police killings, because it's embedded into the system. They are allowed to do this in the beginnings of professional policing in the U.S. have to do with controlling Black bodies, living or dead, just making sure that they weren't infringing on the ability of the state to produce wealth. That is what policing is for. And everything about it now will tell you that, in terms of who's in the prison system, who's being arrested, who's being killed. Black and white police officers can kill with impunity, period. And so, like, if tomorrow it jumps from 1% to 2%,
right,
that just means that 98% of police officers now feel like they can kill people and get away with it instead of 99. That's not a win at all. Like, that's not, that trajectory doesn't work for me.
And this is a really specific case of going into somebody else's private home.
Exactly.
When they're alone and shooting them.
Mm-hmm. Like, so, why wasn't it good enough that Michael Brown was a teenager who was unarmed?
On his knees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why wasn't it good enough that Walter Scott was running away with his back to the police? Why wasn't it good enough that Jason Washington, here in Portland, wasn't actually acting violently, had a license to carry the gun that he had.
Also shot.
Why wasn't it good enough that Kendra James was unarmed and pregnant in a car, in the back of a car?
Yes.
Why wasn't that, like, this case is so cut and dry, and that is why this happened. Like, and I will always commend the work of the activists surrounding instances like this. And, like, there are people pushing in every city every day for stuff like this, before Black Lives Matter, far before Black Lives Matter, and there will continue to be communities of people who are fighting for the people that they love,
yeah,
to get what they see as justice. And and people lose those battles every single day, even when they're kicking and screaming down the doors of the courtroom. Mm. This was easy for people to see, because how are you going to go into somebody's house and kill them? Mm-hmm. Like, because you're an idiot and didn't know where your apartment was.
Yeah. And just for people who are listening in who maybe don't fully understand or don't fully agree yet with us saying Black Lives Matter or fully affirming the Black Lives Matter movement, I just want to make it clear that Black Lives Matter was originally an intervention in 2014. This was after Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri by Officer Darren Wilson, his tragic and infamous last words were, "My hands are up, don't shoot." Mm-hmm. And he shot him. He was on his knees. He had just graduated from high school. And the officer did not get convicted. And since then, the Black Lives Matter movement asserted, even its name, I should clarify, is not to say that all lives don't matter, because of course that has always been the popular rejection of Black Lives Matters, is to say all lives matter. Mm-hmm. And people who mean that in earnest, I think most don't, but people who mean it in earnest should know that to assert that Black Lives Matter is not to assert that all lives don't. Mm-hmm. It is a recognition that under our system, mm-hmm, Black lives do not matter, mm-hmm, and that we assert that they must. Mm-hmm. It's an outcry. Mm-hmm. It's to say all lives can't matter until Black lives matter, because of the way that they're systemically undervalued in our society. Mm-hmm. And in the case of police being able to kill with impunity, it is the most sort of on display,
mm-hmm,
way example that people are able to see that their lives don't matter, that they can just be shot down on the street in front of everybody with their back to the cop, with their on their hands and knees in a car, mm-hmm, driving away, go down the list, all the names we know, and there will be no justice for you. That is a way of your government telling you your lives don't matter. Mm-hmm. So that was always the intervention. Mm-hmm. And I want to clarify, mm-hmm, that. It's been a while since we've had, since we've had
a
massive uprising, mm-hmm, under that banner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is the good part. And these small victories are the building blocks that we need to build struggle, because people must feel like that there is something to win and that they have the power to win to be able to engage in struggle and to even get started in struggle. Because I'm sure that there are people out in the Dallas community who are feeling more empowered to be involved in struggle because they see that there can be wins and there can be some semblance of justice in whatever way that you see it. Yeah. And we have to push harder. And I think it's important what you said about most people who say all lives matter are not saying it in earnest. And there are people who have kind of been duped by those who are not saying it in earnest, but are actually saying it to push an agenda that is the very thing that those who say Black Lives Matter are fighting against, an agenda of white supremacy, state violence, to say that if you focus on this state-sanctioned violence, then you are somehow undermining the good of your community, which is ridiculous and prioritizes only those, yeah, who have privilege. And so when you hear that, if you're inclined to agree with it, maybe look at the intentions of the people who are talking.
Yeah, it is Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. activists that have been at ICE demonstrations, mm-hmm. right, or anti-ICE demonstrations mm-hmm. when there were kids who are being killed mm-hmm. by the U.S. government. Black Lives Matter activists are mm-hmm. there mm-hmm. in solidarity with them. Nobody is there saying all lives matter.
I'm here because all lives matter, and I want to make sure that it's not just Black Lives Matter.
So,
just never heard of her. Never heard of it.
Make sure that you're bringing that news to your friends.
Yeah.
That the All Lives Matter crowd mm-hmm. is not fighting for any yeah. lives that are being taken by the U.S. government that are not yeah. Black.
It's the same. It's the same. Just as kind of like saying that you're pro-life. Well, it's like, well, why are you asserting that? You're really only asserting it to make sure that somebody doesn't get something. You're not saying it because you're on the front lines for everybody's
right,
life.
Right, of like a welfare rights movement yes. or something like that.
No, you're not pro-life. This is there's a political agenda underneath yeah. this. I mean, and there's a political agenda underneath everything that BLM does too. But that agenda has to do with human life and people having their basic needs met.
It's interesting to know also that this was a man, like not that I want to make this any more spicy than it is. This is like a very hot issue, but mm-hmm. you know, he wasn't poor and mm-hmm. he wasn't in the hood. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't gang affiliated mm-hmm. or any of the other stupid things
that police always go to,
right? This was like the most stand up guy you can imagine.
I mean, look at his family.
Was he an accountant or? Yeah,
I think he was an accountant.
What was his? He worked for a financial company doing really well, lived in a really good, secured building.
Good
in
enough
nice
to live.
Part of Dallas.
To live the floor, I forget if it was above or below. Above, the floor yeah. above this woman, mm-hmm. the floor above her.
Yeah.
So a little bit nicer than she's living.
Yeah. So I just want to point that out too, that like that's not going to save you either, and that it has to be that we're feeling emboldened to mm-hmm. go after. I always say go after the budget, cut mm-hmm. the budget, cut the budget, cut the mm-hmm. budget, cut the budget.
Take the tools that they have
yeah.
to enact this violence away.
It's not the only thing, but they are able to continue to amass mm-hmm. more power like they are mm-hmm. because they continue to assert that they're underfunded, they need more money.
Exactly.
They take that money and they become more powerful to turn around and say that we need more, and then, you know, we end up in just like a complete militaristic country like we are.
No, it's exactly, I mean, the police are wolves in working class clothing. And so they said when you cut the budget of a department, it degrades the working conditions that they're in. And when people's working conditions are degraded, they will leave. And then that department does not have the capacity to run like it used to. And that is what we want. We don't want to just fix the systems that they're working in.
And why don't we want to fix the systems that they're working in?
Because they're working exactly the way that they're supposed to. Because slavery.
We're only laughing because Olivia and I have had to explain this, I don't know, 50 times now. Okay, so we've been working together on cutting police budgets together for about
5 years.
5 years. Mm-hmm. So that's why I put Olivia on the spot. So please say.
So the way that I feel like it's best explained is that in the 1700s, that's when we first see slave patrols, which are the origins of professional policing in the United States, primarily made up of white indentured servants who were sent out to capture and control runaway slaves. And they were put in this position specifically to keep black slaves and white indentured servants apart. And so the white indentured servants could be elevated to a higher class status, and their job was to wrangle in these runaway slaves so that they can continue to provide cheap labor to the colonizers too.
So how were they maintaining law and order before then?
Psh, I don't know.
Because of
my historical knowledge stops.
I just want people to have a clear conception that before the rise of policing through slave patrols, slave catching patrols, that people
society did maintain itself.
Yes, people did not depend on huge police departments in order to keep the peace where they were living.
Yeah.
So I just want people to understand that that these things are possible. It wasn't until there was a job for capturing runaway slaves that we have policing as we know it in the United States.
Well, because people conflate policing, the word policing, with the word safety or the words maintaining safety. And there are many ways that communities and families and people maintain their own safety outside of police. And there's many ways that we should be doing that. But we're made weaker by the way that we depend on police in our communities, especially if you're in a marginalized community. Anyway, so, but the slaves at this point were an indentured servant, were building the foundations of the United States. This country is built, like the infrastructure of this country is built on the backs of slaves and low-wage workers. And so slavery is abolished, and we don't have time to go through all of it now because we have 10 minutes. But
formal slavery.
But we have, formal slavery is abolished, and slowly we have seen the cheap labor that builds this country, the cheap labor that nobody wants to do, and that you get people to do through coercion and through through coercion in all different kinds of ways and enslaving them and capturing them, has been transferred from formal slavery into the prison system. We have more black people incarcerated right now than we did slaves when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. And so this system is not actually meant to keep you safe. It is just another form of maintaining a system of cheap labor, because believe it or not, people in prison are not being given resources to better themselves and to come out as healthy and whole people. Many of them are actually doing cheap labor for corporations and for the state.
So speed up, right, to 2019 in Dallas, Texas, and that you have a police officer who feels like, hey, I can get away with this. You know, I can kill this guy in his own house. Mm-hmm. I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. How can you get to that point?
I mean, because I think that people are so quick to think that officers are just good people because, again, we conflate policing with maintaining safety. Police officers to me are brainwashed people. If you can continue to work in this system where you see your coworkers get away, because we talk about murders, but then police are brutalizing people every single day. Police are locking people up for minimal things every single day. Police harass people every single day. Police rape people every single day. And if you can work in a system
and they're protected by other officers every single day, they're protected by their coworkers every single day when they do that. So it's show me an instance where another officer has charged and gotten justice for someone who was hurt by a police officer. Show me.
And if it really is a case of bad apples, then how are we happening to see all of these murders that aren't done by bad apples? And if it really is a case of bad apples, then why can't we get the bad apples out?
Where are the good apples at? Calling them out. Nowhere.
Not a single one.
They're not here. They protect each other. They call it the blue line.
Yeah, it's a brother. It's a brother.
Oh my God, that's why they have that American flag, the black and white American flag with the blue
lives
line.
Matter, because they that's have what one that is blue
when you
line.
See that. You better be afraid.
Oh, I am horrified of that flag, and you should be too. But yeah, if it really was a matter of good apples, then we would see some good apples. But instead, we see people get away with this every single day. And whether or not Amber Geiger knew exactly what, like, had staked this man out and planned to go into his apartment and planned to kill him.
You think so?
Or whether, I'm saying whether or not, or whether or not she just walked into his apartment and saw a black person sitting in her apartment and thought, and just killed him. This is a person who is in a force that I believe brainwashes you. because do you really think that these people are being trained to have like empathy and to de-escalate and to take care of people when we see the results of the work that they do, which is brutalizing, brutalizing, locking up and killing black and brown people in their neighborhoods every single day.
And for every officer that hasn't done that, you know, if you've never gone into somebody's house and killed them, cool. But that it can't be that because not every officer is out here brutalizing people every day, that we should not be calling into question the system from which they spring. It's a stupid and simple analogy, but like you don't go out of your way to praise someone when they get your order right at a restaurant, right? That's what you're supposed to do. I want to make that clear. That when I talk about this good apple, bad apple thing, it's because it gets droned into my head all the time because people see me out, they talk to me. It's the main thing that I get challenged on. Well, after trans women are not real women. That's the main thing. But that's next week's show. Next week, we'll talk about TERFs and how dangerous that is. But right after that, people challenge me on...
we get past that and then they
bad apples in the police department. You know, they're not all bad. My critique of the police is not based on their personality or whether or not they're like bad people. It's on the results that we're getting.
And that's something that is helpful for people and that also like shakes people is when I say that people. I have met police officers who I think probably in their real lives are not, I would not be bothered to like be in the same room as them and sit on the bus. I don't care. I don't care. You work in a system that allows you to kill people that look like me with impunity. And if you killed me right now, you wouldn't be held accountable for it the same way that I would be if I killed you. And so on that basis, I will not trust you because it doesn't matter what your intentions are. You have power over me. It's like Kwame Ture said, whether a man wants to lynch me is not my problem. If he has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. My problem is that you can do whatever you want to me and you have power over me no matter what you do on any given day just because for the purposes of maintaining wealth of people who absolutely don't care about me.
So for people who are just tuning in, we're a couple minutes out. We've been talking about Amber Geiger, murderer. Police officer
sexting
from oh my god, who was sexting someone she was having an affair with 20 minutes before she killed Botham Jean, a black man in Dallas, Texas, who was her neighbor. She broke into his house and killed him, and she was convicted and sentenced to 10 years. And we've been talking about some of the ins and outs of this case, including her being openly racist, saying that the people who are out at MLK Day should be maced, laughing at the fact that MLK is dead. She called herself a racist, didn't make any qualms about it. Her
inspirational quote,
Kill first, die last.
And she will die last. She's going to be locked up for 10 years.
So this is the end of this story, but there's going to be more. And I just want to close by encouraging people to show up and support people who are on the front lines that are fighting for black lives, that are fighting for police to not be able to just slaughter us with impunity. People around the world are being killed, including here at home, by police, and there's never any justice. And if you want something to be done about that, you got to get active. And I'm sorry to tell you that because I know life is beating you down in the daily grind, but if you don't do anything, they'll get you.
Don't shoot Portland. Disarm PSU. Black Lives Matter, just a few organizations that are doing something to beat back not just police officers who murder people, but the power police have to murder people at any given time with impunity.
Thank you, everybody. It's Alyssa.
It's Olivia.
See you next week. Good luck. Bye.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at KBOO.FM. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio. I wish somebody would come and ease
my troubling mind. Oh, from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary. We will ease your troubled mind with licensed mental health counselor Cheryl Jefferson. Political analysis provided by the Prophet of Rage, and calling in from the planet of rhythm and blues, musicologist Professor Soul. From the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary. I'm your host, Lanita Duke. They tell me when you tell somebody your troubles, trouble fly away from you.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor.